Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and of course to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It's great to have you here as always. Now, today's episode is one that I've been looking forward to recording for a long, long time. And before I introduce our guest, I just want to share a little note that if you happen to be a dental practice owner and you're wanting to take your practice to the next level, whatever that means for you, maybe it's earning more, working less, achieving a level of mastery in your practice, then I'm going to encourage you to come across to the Savvy Dentist Facebook group. And in that group, you'll find tools and tips and trainings there that are going to help you create a practice and a life that you love. And ultimately, that's what the business is there for. It's a vehicle to express your highest values, to achieve the things that you want to achieve. And we've got a lot of resources there that will help you in that quest. Now, my guest today is someone who's very special. He is a human behavior specialist, an educator, an internationally published author with over 40 books in 36 languages, another book on the way, and he's a highly sought after business consultant. He's been teaching for over 47 years and has taught and consulted in over 150 countries. He advises people from all walks of life on personal and professional development and achievement. His clients range from CEOs and financiers to healthcare professionals, politicians, celebrity actors, and many, many more. Now, of course, I'm talking about Dr. John DeMartini. And Dr. John has spent many times on stage with noted and inspired educators, including people such as Stephen Covey, Wayne Dyer, Deepak Chopra, Donald Trump, Richard Branson, Steve Wozniak, and a heap more. So, Dr. John DeMartini, thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang with us. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, it's been good to catch up again. We recently had you as a speaker at our Practice Mastery event, and I need to tell you that the feedback from that event was just through the roof. It was phenomenal. So firstly, I want to express my thanks to you for that.
And thank you.
I wanted to just begin today's conversation with a fairly broad question, and I wanted to ask you what you would consider a life that's well-lived looks like. Is there a definition that you have around that? What's a life well-lived?
Good question. So often, individuals compare themselves to other people, individually or collectively, and subordinate to individual authorities, mothers, fathers, preachers, teachers, social dynamics of community, city, state, nation, or world, traditions, conventions, and mores, and they inculcate and inject some of those idealisms and values into their life and cloud the clarity of what's authentic for them, and then have confusion and uncertainty about their path. But an individual who is not comparing themselves to others, but more comparing their own daily actions to their own most inspiring intrinsic dreams and objectives, those are the individuals that will typically live more congruently, authentically, and awaken their essential self instead of their existential personas. And that individual, regardless of what it may be, whether it's raising beautiful children, whether it's a social cause, combination, business, wealth building, physical fitness, spiritual quest, or any combination, being honest and integral to what's really valuable to them is a life that's fulfilled. And can I share a story? Do we have the time to do a story?
We have plenty of time to do stories. I'd love to hear a story.
So I was in London near Kensington Palace area, and there's a lovely lady attending my Breakthrough Experience program. And we were asking, so what do you want to dedicate your life to? What is the legacy and immortal contribution do you want to leave that will be written about in Wikipedia, you might say? And we were pursuing this, and she was blank. And I always say that your life demonstrates what you value most. Look at what you spontaneously do every day, and that tells you what's really important to you. but she was afraid to admit what it was. So I asked her, what do you do every single day that nobody ever has to remind you to do, that you spontaneously do, that really inspires you, that you love doing? And she says, I don't know. I said, no, everyone knows. Look again. What does your life demonstrate? And she was afraid to say it. And I said, but what, I'm not interested in subjectively judging it. I'm just interested in just looking at it. What does your life demonstrate? And it turned out to be spending her time with her kids. Mm. And she said, I spend most of my day with my kids. I love being with my kids. And I said, you have this idea that you're comparing yourself to some of your girlfriends that you think have businesses or social causes, and you're thinking what I'm doing is not enough. And you're comparing yourself like a cat to a fish who's swimming, and you're wondering why you're not swimming well. Mm-hmm. And you're not honoring what is really valuable to you. I said, Rose Kennedy from the Kennedy family, which I have one of their books and the actual mission statement written by her hands in the book, said in her mission statement that I dedicate my life to raising a family of world leaders. Wow. And I said, and that was great enough. She didn't have to compare herself to another woman who's running a business or doing a social cause or being spiritual or whatever, or fitness or beautiful. That creates dysmorphia. She was a mother. And she started breaking down in tears. And she said to me, that's all I've ever wanted to do with my life. I wanted to raise a beautiful family. She started crying. Wow. And I put my arms around her. And I said, that is who you are. That's your authentic self. Give yourself permission to be you. The magnificence of who you are is far greater than all the fantasies you'll impose on yourself from the outside. Give yourself permission. And she cried and she wrote out her mission statement. I want to raise a magnificent group of kids. That's what I spend every day focusing on. But I've been judging myself, trying to be a cat, you know, trying to swim and not honoring it. And then not wanting to admit what it is because it's not good enough. And anytime you exaggerate some people around you, you're going to self-depreciate yourself in comparison. And that's what clouds the clarity of an authentic, well-lived life in a lot of people. Conformity.
It's a really interesting topic, and there's so many threads of conversation I'd like to pick up there. And in preparation for our conversation tonight, I did, of course, make some notes. But I want to ask, why do we try to be fish or cats, trying to be the other? What is it that, as human beings, we get caught up with other people's views of success or other people's visions for their life and try and assume that for our own life? Why is it that we do that so frequently?
Well, thousands of years ago, humans were nomadic. Mm. And they were in families, then kinship, then clanship, then township, then cities, then states, then nations and worlds. And it's a social animal development. And being out on your own in the wild in a hunting and gathering phase is sustainable, but it's still dangerous. Mm. So people found out that being with groups was more sustainable. And then when they went into sedentary agricultural societies and put a social class structure together with economic exchange, you became used to delegating things to others, including decisions. Mm. And social structures became, and we have what is called brain offloading, where we unload our decisions onto people we think might have knowledge that we don't. And we undergo with our mirror neurons chameleon's effect, where we try to duplicate what they do because they must know. And this is what leads to conformity, or what Ernest Becker says in his Denial of Death, a survival of the mass herd instead of the individual. And this is a form of entropy to the human psyche, but it allows you to survive. It's a survival strategy. Mm. And most people are frightened of transcending that for fear of rejection, and fear of banishment and abandonment into the exiled unknown. And really, it's not even the unknown. It's the thing you conjure up in your mind of feeling alienated. That's why so many people join religions and join sports and go into herd constructs, because they have an identity in the herd, and they'll sacrifice the herd because of survival. But when you stop and think about the irrationality of that, less than 1% become the Nobel Prize winners. Mm. Less than 1% become the Olympic medalist. Less than 1% become the billionaires. Less than 1% become the great business leaders like Amazon. Great, you know, political figures. like a Gandhi or something, it's less than 1%. So following the herd is almost guaranteed to be impoverishing as far as mastery.
And that's a really interesting point, because while we understand that that makes intuitive sense when we hear you articulate it that way, following the herd, as you say, has been wired into us and programmed into us over millennia. How then do people find the courage to break away from the herd and to live that inspired life, and to then say, how do the Gandhis find their path and rise to the top? How do the Nobel Prize winners cope with being an outlier? Because even outliers need belonging, right?
Well, if you're not creating a culture, you're going to follow a culture.
Yeah. Okay.
I chose to create one, not a follow it. And I found that that's a big difference. Many of the Nobel Prize winners go unappreciated for 30 to 60 years. I've made a very extensive study of Nobel Prize winners, great leaders and philosophers over the century, last 50 years almost, 40 years, 47 years. And most of them got ridiculed, violently opposed, criticized, ridiculed. But their certainty, because of the authenticity, and their willingness to be the hero and the villain within themselves, allowed them to endure it. It's the amygdala's addiction to praise and the fear of rejection of that praise that traps people. And this is, you have to be the unborrowed visionary, as Ayn Rand said, in order to liberate yourself from the herd. I'd like to share another story if I could.
You can share as many as you like, John. Go for it.
I had a doctor. This might be applicable because there may be doctors listening in mostly.
There will definitely be doctors listening.
Yeah, I figured. So I had this doctor call me up after a talk I did that he was attending. And he says, I'd like to have you consult with me. I said, fine. I'd like to have you help me become more successful. And I said, fantastic. And the first question in the consult was, so where are you successful? And he said, well, no, Dr. DeMartini, I'm not successful. I want to be successful. That's why I'm hiring you. I said, great. So where are you successful? And he said, well, Dr. DeMartini, somehow I'm not getting across to you. I'm not, and I want to be, and I'm not communicating that to you. I said, I understand, but where are you successful? and he says, but I'm not. And I said, my certainty exceeds your doubt. So I know better than that. Because you can never envy anybody about somebody else's life unless they're reminding you of something you're too humble to admit you already have. So I want to have you go look again and look at where you're successful. Where are you getting to achieve what you're intending, and you're not stopping and you're persevering and you're achieving it? And he leaned back and he goes, okay. I have an amazing relationship with my wife. We've been together over 10 years and we literally are two peas in a pod. And we just have this amazing relationship. And I love my wife deeply. And I said, fantastic. Great. Let's put that down. Where else are you successful? As you're calling it, achieving high. I have a son who's in baseball, and we may win the pennant this summer. I'm the coach, and we really work together, and we're really close. And I think we're going to win the pennant this year, and we're going to have number one. I said, fantastic. And where else are you successful? And he goes, all the family work in the yard, the whole family. My son, my daughter, my wife, and I all work in the yard. We're going to have yard of the summer again this year because we really do a nice job on the yard. I said, fantastic. And that's a clear intention that you set out for. Yes. What else? Well, my wife's mother, my mother-in-law, lives with us and helps us with us, and she's amazing. And very few people I've ever known get along with their mother-in-law. And I have this amazing relationship and really respect her and appreciate it. She really helps us. It makes our family work. And I said, fantastic. What else? Well, on Wednesdays and sometimes Sundays, I do lay ministry. And since I was in my 20s, I wanted to be a lay minister and do that. And I do my spiritual contribution on Wednesdays and Sundays. And that's a goal of mine. And I feel I'm ticked that off. I said, great. And we made a list of where he had achieved things that were on his list, his bucket list.
Yep.
And then I said to him, the only reason why you think you're not successful is because you're comparing yourself to some other doctor. So who is that? It could be one or many. It could be male or female. It could be close or distant. It could be real or virtual. But who is that? And he says, I think I know who that is. There's a guy up the street, up the top of the hill. It's got a 6,000 square foot house, 3-car garage, lots of cars, and has a big booming practice and makes a lot of money. And yeah, I'm definitely, compared to him, I just don't have the practice he does. And I said, great. Do you know his family and his life very well? I said, yeah, pretty good. How's his relationship with his wife? He said, well, it's interesting you ask. They it's quite volatile, and there's sometimes they break up and then they get back together, and we didn't ever know what the status is. Mm. And yeah, it's quite turmoil sometimes. Sometimes he almost has flings and stuff. And I said, and how about, does he have kids? Yes. You have a son? Yes. How about his relationship with his son? Well, that's interesting you ask that. He's got some challenging in his school, and he's quite rambunctious. He's a bit arrogant, and they got to deal with him a lot of counseling and stuff. Mm. And I said, in the yard, how's his yard? Does he take care of his yard like you guys do? Or no, he has people to take over. I think he doesn't even pay attention to it. He kind of drives over it, doesn't even pay attention to it. And what about the mother-in-law? Oh, that's interesting. He's actually moved out and made sure that they don't even contact, because there's no way that lady can be around them.
Yeah.
And what about church and that type of thing? Does he participate in ministry? He goes, oh, no. It's not even much. That's not his priority. I said, let me explain to you. This gentleman that you've been admiring does not have more success than you. He has a different form of success than you. And his hierarchy of values is creating his form of success. And your hierarchy of values is creating yours. If you would be willing to sacrifice the areas that you have it and go and have a change in values to have his, that's doable. You can change your values and shift the whole value structure and have a new trajectory. But you would probably now have chaos in the areas he has chaos in. Mm. So the question is, could you actually swap roles with him? Oh, God, no. I said, you've been comparing yourself to that without thinking through. And the reality, he doesn't have more, he has less. He probably looks at you and admires you for your family, admires you for your spiritual. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, he's probably having the same illusion that you do. So remember, envy is ignorance and imitation is suicide. We're not here to compare ourselves to others and put people on pedestals or pits. We're here to put them in our hearts and realize that they have their own set of successes and, quote, failures, and you do too, and nobody's greater or lesser. They just have it in different areas. I just got off a consult today with a woman who's dating a very wealthy billionaire, but he is very, very hard to deal with,
yeah.
Very demanding, very commanding. And has been with probably 40 women and has multiple children. And he's just has extreme high value on business. He's super achieving in that, private jets, the whole thing. But in relationships is low on his value. And he just keeps going through one after another and paying for kids and dealing with chaos and resentment and stuff. I said, he's not more successful. He's just living according to his values. And whatever's high in your value, you bring order to. Whatever's low in your value, you have chaos in. Unless you know how to super task and link all areas of your life into what you value most and master your life, which is training. So I just wanted to share that, because doctors sometimes go through what I call the second house, third child syndrome. And they end up, now the wife's not working. They're having to work harder, buy a house they don't really have. This depreciating and costing, having kids. She's now having an affair with the kids. He's having an affair with the work. They're now having questions or questioning their relationship. Mm-hmm. And they don't understand that as they get supported by children and supported by work, they have more conflict. And that's peace and war in the family. And there's an androgyny that's being generated there. And they don't understand and are not educated about human behavior. They can set up idealisms and fantasies about how it's supposed to look and create tremendous amount of torture in their life. Because anytime you have expectations that don't match reality or your values or their values, you're going to have the ABCDs of negativity.
It's really interesting that you talk about, John, because as you're sharing that story of the doctor, you reminded me of my grandmother, actually. And my grandmother was someone who was really influential in my life. And, you know, when you're younger, you tend to bypass the parents and go to the grandparents, and there's a different relationship there. And she was my person for that. And I remember one day comparing myself to someone else unfavorably, and she stopped me in my tracks, actually. And I'll share this with you, and you feel free to speak to it. I think we're highlighting the same point. But she said to me, Jesse, what you need to understand in life is that comparisons either make you feel superior or inferior, and neither is helpful. And I think that's the point.
Whenever you look down on somebody and are conscious of their downsides and unconscious of their upsides and blind with ignorance. You become blind and ignorant of your own side, and you become puffed up and aware or conscious of your upsides and unconscious of your downsides. Mm. And you're too proud to admit what you see in them is inside you. Mm. And this pride is a facade, a persona, a mask you're wearing, covering up the magnificent, authentic, and essential self. And the same thing if you put people on pedestals, you then minimize yourself and the same thing. And anytime you exaggerate or minimize yourself because you resent or infatuate others, you lose your power and you end up with disowned parts. And nature, the wisdom of your physiology, the wisdom of sociology, psychology, and even theology is offering you a feedback by experiences, chaos, challenges to make sure you go back to authenticity.
Yeah.
Nature levels the playing field. The tall poppy syndrome or the doll is a classical socioeconomic game, but nature is automatically homeostatting an allostatic perturbated perception of ourself. When we're unstable with our emotions, we have these perturbations that vacillate that are not authentic. And what's interesting is I've asked, I don't know, maybe 50,000 people in a live seminar, maybe more, if you had 24 hours to live, what would you do with your life? And consistently, they would go to the people that have contributed to their life and appreciate them and love them. Mm. And people want to be loved and appreciated for who they are, and they want to make a difference. You can't make a difference fitting into being other people. You dilute that difference. You can only make a difference when you're unique to your own set of values, and you only really are authentic there. And if you want to be loved and appreciated for who you are, you have to be willing to be who you are. Mm. Or otherwise, no one will know who you are.
And that's exactly right. And that comes back to the fear of breaking out from the herd a bit. And we're talking about values a lot. And you alluded to earlier, you know, what do you surround yourself with? What do you focus on every day? What do you not have to be reminded about? What else are the clues that people listening to this audio could, you know, think about to go, actually, what are my highest values? And because here's what I suspect happens, John. I suspect people have a list of socially accepted values, and for the people listening to the audio, I'm just doing air quotes around socially accepted there. They go, you know, it should be family, it should be this, it should be that, it should be that. Therefore, that's the thing. So I guess for those people listening to this, what clues should or could they be looking for in their own life to uncover those authentic hierarchy of values? And when I went through this exercise with you, it was really liberating for me, because I got rid of the things that were socially acceptable and just got to be me. And I've really appreciated that.
Well, there have been numerous thought leaders, philosophers, psychologists that have explored axiology and the values of society. And what you find in values of society is a full spectrum. Hmm. Believe it or not, everybody's needed. Mm-hmm. And it's a full spectrum. And for every individual that's dedicated to family, there's somebody that's not. Mm. And everybody's dedicated to business, there's somebody that's not. And there's actually a pair of opposites necessary in the laws of similarities and differences in society called the law of heuristic escalation that's automatically there to make sure that the society is building and destroying everything so it has remodeling abilities to transform, to adapt to a changing universal environment. It's like a living organism. Mm. And just like we have metabolism made out of autonomic polarities, we have a metabolism of opposites in psychology, in society, the values. So to assume a tribal thinking of a particular location in society and think, there's my values, I have to live and fit into that, is automatically limiting. Mm. It'd be like saying, well, God was a monoglot and spoke only Arabic or only Hebrew or only this country or that, you know. And limiting it to some anthropomorphism instead of a universal field of quantum field or something. So first of all, these social idealisms are automatically improbable. And they'll say things like peace and kind and honesty and integrity and all the basic stuff. But I have no interest in that because that is not even obtainable. There's no such thing as an honest person. Diogenes traveled all over when time of Socrates and Plato looking around for an honest person all over Europe and never found one. We're all skewed things with subjective biases. I prove that in my programs weekly. So So setting those are not really going to get you any other except internal conflict and moral hypocrisies. But looking carefully at what your life really, truly, objectively demonstrates does. Mm. So I look at how do you fill your space? Because things that are really valuable to you, you keep around you. Mm. And things that aren't, you discard. I look at where you spend your time. You find time, make time, spend time on things that are really valuable to you. You run out of time for things that aren't. Mm. I always find time for my research and teaching, but not for socializing and partying and stuff like that. Not important to me. You look at where you're energized, because when you're doing things high in your values, your energy goes up. When you're doing things low in your values, your energy drains. Mm. I look at where you spend your money. You find money, make money, spend money, and get money, and will even borrow money for things that are really valuable to you, but you will not spend a dime on something that doesn't provide a value. I look at what you are ordered in, because things that are really high in your value, you put into structure and you put patterns of order to it. I look at where you're disciplined spontaneously. Nobody has to remind you to do it. Nobody has to remind me to do my research and teaching. I do it every single day, 7 days a week. But you'd have to remind me to drive a car. I haven't driven that in 30 something years.
Wow.
And so you also look at what you think about how you would love your life that actually shows evidence of coming true. Hmm. Not what you're thinking about that you self-depreciate. That's not happening. But what are you thinking about? So I've been thinking since I was 17 of traveling the world and teaching. That's coming true. That's true. I've also thought about being an international sex symbol. None of that's true. There is no sex there.
There's still time, John. There's still time.
Yeah, there's conversation about it. It's a joke anyway.
Yeah,
but the point is, you look at what you think about how you want your life that shows evidence coming true. Then you look at what are you visualizing in your mind's eye, your innermost dominant vision about how you want your life and what shows evidence coming true. What are you internally dialoguing with internal conversation about how you want your life that shows evidence coming true? It's got to have evidence. If there's no evidence, don't waste your time on it.
Yeah.
What do you love conversing with other people about most consistently? What do you keep bringing conversation to? Because you'll keep moving the conversation. People come up to you and go, how's business? How's your golf game? How's your investments? How's your relationship? How's your health? Look at what inspires you and what's common to the people who inspire you that brings tears to your eyes. Tears to your eyes. Mm. I had a goal that I set nearly 40 years ago, 39 years ago. Last year in November, I finished a 49-year goal that I set at 16. I surfed the North Shore pipeline on a big day. But this year, I finally set a goal. I set this 39 years ago, and we're closing a deal with Nightingale Conant. They're going to take my library of materials and put it out into the world. And that was something I wrote down that I'd like to have happen 39 years ago. It took 39 years, but I didn't give up on it. But if I look at those things that inspire me that brings tears to my eyes, those are indications, because those are feedback mechanisms to let you know you're authentic. Mm. Then you look at what is it you have that's been a persistent goal that you've had and you persisted and persisted and you made it happen. And then, or it's on its way, it's close. And the last one is, what do you spontaneously want to learn, read, study about, watch YouTubes about, videos on, et cetera. And what do you absolutely cannot wait to learn? If you look at those are really real objective things that you can see and you can videotape. If you videotaped your life for a 6-month period and looked at how you spent your time and how you filled your space and looked at what's there, you would see evidently what you're really committed to.
Yeah.
And then structuring a life around that, prioritizing daily actions to fulfill that and delegating the rest away is freedom. There's a path of inspiration, and that's how you get out of the herd.
And that's what I love. And again, we've spoken about this a few times now, and I really love the fact that, you know, it's about being singularly focused on your own hierarchy of values. It's about creating the life that you want to live around those values and stripping away the inessential or the unessential. Fantastic. John, throughout our conversation a few weeks ago, and again, you've referenced it slightly today, you've spoken about a couple of performers, you know, high performers in different fields, whether they be Nobel laureates or otherwise. Recently, you know, in Australia, it's now 2020. 20 years ago, we had the Sydney Olympics. And so there's been some celebration or remembering 2000 Olympics in Sydney. And at that particular time, there was a 400-meter race in Australian sporting history, very famous. Cathy Freeman won the 400 meters final, won the Olympic gold, came out wearing the Nike Swift suit, et cetera, et cetera. And recently, there's been a documentary about that. And there was a really interesting quote in that documentary I wanted to ask you about. And the quote is from Kathy Freeman herself. And she said, the competition did not assert themselves. So she was running around the track and she noticed that no one was making a move. And they felt that they couldn't win and it was my night. And so I wanted to speak about competition because I know that, you know, I have some views around competition, whether it's real or otherwise, but I wanted to talk about competition, how you see competition, and particularly around the intimidation. I guess we're probably getting back to that subjugation point again. But how do you view competition? How do you remain focused on your mission? How do you, you know, see that? Because, again, it was a really interesting documentary.
Well, sometimes in interviews, what we say about why we do what we do doesn't always match what's actually going on, first of all.
Yeah.
Because sometimes we're not even conscious of what's really driving us. But my observation, I worked, I guess it was about 6 weeks ago, with a runner. And she's in that type of competition. She's been in Olympic competition. She, in fact, is Olympic gold medalist. And we discussed that very thing. She said, if I even look to my left or right, I've already lost.
Mm-hmm.
I have to see what's ahead of me and not be distracted.
Mm.
And if I look and see if I'm ahead or see that I'm behind, I'm already judging something else in comparison.
Yeah.
And it's the contrast that divide the power. And so I think the competition is the difference between what you're setting out for inside yourself and where you are. I have people quite often come up to me and say, well, you know, so-and-so does this. Why don't you do that? So-and-so does this. Why don't you do that? And I go, but those aren't me.
Mm.
Those aren't my values.
Mm.
There's lots of things I could do that would give me those achievements, but those don't mean much to me.
Mm.
I have my own that means something to me.
Yeah.
And so I think having the competition as a bar to set to exceed within yourself, I have no problem with.
Mm.
But the second you envy or imitate somebody else or look above or below, you've lost the game. I was walking with Tiger Woods at the British Open a number of years back because he came onto the ship I live on and he had a nice presentation there. And then he invited us to come while he was there in Scotland at Edinburgh. And what's interesting is when we were there, we got to walk with him down the fairway, just to the side, and listen to him and his caddy. And his caddy was brilliant and part of the psychological team. Because what he did is he shot a ball directly down the fairway.
Mm-hmm.
And Tiger doesn't usually get super excited or elated until he actually wins. But what he did is he was nodding. And the guy said, we've got 21 holes to go, right? 21 holes to get through this whole thing. We've got a lot of holes to do. 18 holes in this tournament. And he says, and when you're in the perfect lay, that's when you need to focus. And he says, and then when he would go off to the side or in the sand or something like that, he said, this is when you shine. So he was calming him down from a nice position and resetting him up. This is when you come up. So he was literally neutralizing him as a caddy to keep him centered. Because if he thought that now he's successful and he's way ahead of everybody, that's when you blow it.
Mm.
Or when you're really behind, that's when you start comparing again.
Mm.
He kept him steady. And I watched that and I thought, that's part of his team that's making him do well too.
Yeah.
And I think the Tiger, and this is my personal feeling, and I'm just going to speak about Tiger because I didn't get to chat with him about it afterwards. When he had that craziness with all the girls, they said was 16, which you know there had to be two more. He wouldn't have stopped at 16. He would have done it. The way he handled it, instead of standing up and saying that I'm a hero and a villain, and these are the two sides of my nature, and be strong, as some could handle that.
Mm.
He submitted to the herd.
He did.
And that was the end of his game. And then whenever we do that, we give up on what's really valuable to us. Our back gives out. Our lumbar spine is affected. I've seen that 1,000 times in practice where the spinal responses are there. It's a reflex. And so I really believe that the way he was advised was a disempowering approach.
Mm.
And I would love to have gotten to help him in that area because it was, he bought into the herd's morality instead of stood strong in his individuality. And most people don't get that. As Nietzsche said, I'm the most vicious and the most virtuous. Mm. In The Prince, Machiavelli said, I have to be the hero and the villain, the saint and the sinner, if I'm going to be the great leader. And if you can't handle both sides of yourself and you're trying to get rid of half of yourself, you disempowered yourself. And that's where comparisons undermine people.
And that's a really interesting point. So I have two follow-up questions around that. One, is there a place for contrition in amongst all this, or is there not?
Well, if you study the evolution of values and structures in society, you'll see that the people who set the values are the people at the top.
Yeah.
They live by design. And the people that follow values at the bottom, they live by duty. Mm-hmm. One is ontological, one's deontological. And deontology is duty and the herd instinct. And ontology is the leader's instinct, leader's pursuit. Mm. So the question is who are you going to subordinate to?
Mm, exactly.
And I tell the story in one of my programs, my prophecy program, my 7-day program, that when you're 0 to 1, you don't have any rules. A baby can poo, pee, scratch, bite, do anything, and there's unconditional love there. Mm-hmm. You got 1 year. That's it. That's the contract. 1 year of unconditional love. And then at the second you stand up on your independence and run around and scamper around the house, no, 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 yes, no, yes. And now you're subordinating to mommy's values. And that's the beginning of the internalization of this superego, the authority of the mom, and the beginning of the socialization process. Then comes from 1 to probably about 5 or 6, mommy and daddy both come in. And then preacher and teacher. And you got all the way till 12 years old, you got mother, father, preacher, teacher. At 12, you get puberty coming in and you start to have a little stance against your parents. You start doing things and hide things secretly. And you, because you don't want to live by their values, you want to have your autonomy. And you know your parents want you to be obedient, but don't want you to be too obedient because then you won't stand on your own 2 feet. Exactly. So there's a fine boundary there. Well, now all of a sudden, your social peer pressures become your authorities. You transcend your mom and dad. You lie to your mom and dad. You do things to fit into the peer of the social group, a little clique. And you're following some of the teachers and that kind of thing. You get to 18, you start following a job, your boss, sometimes your teacher, your professor, this kind of things. You go on to college and now you've got professors and your bosses and your mom and dad. Yeah, mom, I'll think about that. And you start transcending one layer of moral injunctions and all the imperatives that you get from them and the rules you get and start to work your way up the ladder. As Kohlberg says, you start out with pain and pleasure being the first moral constructs, then the subordination to individual authority, mother, father, preacher, teacher, then the subordination to collective authorities on the community, city, state, nation, and world. And you work up. By the time you're 40s, you moved up. And eventually you now are at a point you go, you know what? I've hit midlife crisis. Who am I? What do I really want? And I've been fitting in. And what do I really want? Mm. And very few people make it to transcendence where they start to decide. But imagine if you started your own company, your teacher at school no longer becomes so crucial. Mm. And if you become successful, he actually invites you to come and speak as a leader.
Yeah.
And then you start doing a franchise and then the mayor wants to meet you. And you now start to get a little power of the mayor. Then you go to statewide franchise. The governor wants to meet you. You go nationally. And now the president wants to meet you. You go internationally. All the president wants to meet you. And you start setting the rules. And the very rules you once followed are now the rules you're setting. Yeah. And like the Pope, at one time he followed his mom and dad. And then he started ruling a couple billion people, right?
Exactly.
So the question is where do you want to play in the game of ontology or deontology?
Mm.
Because there's no rules out there except the one human beings have made.
Absolutely.
Except the universal laws, natural laws. It's the only thing that nobody can buy. You know, we're not going to overrule gravity. We're not going to overrule radiation. We're not going to overrule the laws of the universe. But human laws, they're made for transcendence for some individuals.
Fantastic. So, John, I have one fairly meaty topic I'd like to finish up with. And I think we've touched on some elements of it already, because one of the things that we, you know, with the Tiger Woods situation, there's an element of self-sabotage there. And we see successful people routinely sabotage their own achievements, routinely sabotage their own lives for a multitude of reasons or a multitude of happenings. I suspect one of the reasons that self-sabotage comes in again is subjugating their values to someone else's. But could you speak to self-sabotage, and could you speak to that as a broad topic?
I've never seen it.
Never seen self-sabotage?
No. What I thought was self-sabotage was the subordination to somebody else's authority and attempting to live in their values and wondering why you can't stay disciplined, focused to get it. And then finally discovering what's really important to you and having the courage to do it instead of banging your head against the wall, thinking you're supposed to do something else. The way you know you are trying to live other people's values is you'll hear inside your head, I should, I ought to, I supposed to, I got to, I have to, I must, which are imperative languages that are dead giveaways of an injected value of an outer authority. And that's the superego that conflicts and moralizes and to try to condemn and knock down the ego and the id kind of thing. But the reality is having the courage to be yourself. When I have somebody that thinks they're self-sabotaging, I ask them, so what's the benefit of you doing what they do? When I stack up enough benefits, they realize they had unconscious motives to go back to being who they really are. But they've been pursuing a unclear path of subordination without realizing it.
And I guess the corollary then, John, is if you're hearing you should, you must, you ought to, that's a different situation.
That's a superordination over another individual expecting to. The sources of anger and aggression, blame and betrayal, criticism and challenge, despair and depression, the desire to escape and exit, frustration, futility, and grief and grouchiness and hatred and hurt and insanity and irritability, what I call the ABCDFGHIs of negativity, are a symptom of expecting others to live in your values, you're going to be angry to them, or you expecting to live in somebody else's values, you're going to be angry at yourself. Neither of those are sustainable.
Yeah.
Both are called sabotage by the mass populace, but they're simply feedback mechanisms to let you know that you are not letting you or they be themselves. And everyone wants to be living according to their own values, honestly, with integrity and love for that. And that's the lesson. That's why the so-called self-sabotage is actually a feedback mechanism to frustrate you, to get you onto track where what's true for you. Like the girl that finally realized she wanted to be with kids.
Yeah.
With kids.
Wonderful. John, you have been incredibly generous with your time today. Firstly, I want to say thank you for coming on our show today. Thank you for the work that you provided for us in our Practice Mastery event. And thank you for allowing me the opportunity to work with you personally as well. It's been an absolute thrill and a pleasure. And I'm looking forward to doing more. I guess I'd like to just ask one little thing. If you were to leave our audience with a particular pearl, gold nugget, whatever it is, or just something to mull over in their mind, what would be the thing that you'd leave our audience with just to take away from today's conversation?
Well, really simple. If you don't fill your day with the highest priority action that inspires you spontaneously from what you have highest on your values, that serves other people, that contributes equitably, sustainably to other people, to earn a fair remuneration, you won't be able to delegate to low priority distractions that will disempower, degrade, devalue your life. So give yourself permission to keep on priority. Make sure it does something that serves so you have the compensation to be able to pay other people to help the entire economy grow by giving other people jobs so you can be free to do what you love.
Lovely. John, thank you once again for your time. You're an absolute scholar and a gentleman. I'm looking forward to seeing you again shortly. And again, I really appreciate your time today, mate. It's been absolutely wonderful as always.
Thank you. Thank you for the interview. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/savvydentist.